call the Jobs and Economic Development Committee together to order. Thank you. First on the agenda today? Oh, do I have to do the minutes? Mecklen, Representative Mecklen, would you like to move the minutes?
So moved.
Any corrections or additions? Deletions? Seeing none. All those in favor of the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Minutes are passed. Is Representative Mecklen, are you ready?
I'm ready, Mr. Chair.
Good man. Representative Mecklen, could you? Representative Mecklen, we're going to hold this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. So if you'd like to move your bill as such.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move House File number 137 for laid over for possible inclusion.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 9, lines 9.16 through 9.24 is what the part that I'm that we're concerned about in this bill, and that's a $230,000 fiscal grant to the Boyce Fort Tribal Employment Rights Office. And with me today, Mr. Chair, members, I have Reed LeBeau, who works on behalf of Boyce Fort, and he'll explain what the program is about.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Chair, identify yourself for the tape. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Reed LeBeau. I'm here on behalf of the Boyce Fort Band of Ojibwe. I want to thank Representative Mecklen for bringing this bill. This is a provision that was in the omnibus bill that was vetoed at the end of last session. And all this provision does is it permits the band an extended period of time to spend the money that was appropriated 2 years ago. 2 years ago, that money was appropriated to the Tribal Employee Rights Organization. And it's a job skills, job training program that's specifically targeted for tribal members on the Boyce Fort band. And all the language in this particular provision does is allow them an extended period of time to spend that appropriation.
Are there any questions? Seeing none, I have one. Are you at the present time, does the band at the present time have this job training program going now?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The TARO office has existed for quite some time, and what has taken time is just working with the state to figure out exactly the mechanisms for what the state needs for reporting purposes and what that program needs to look like and how they work together. That's what's taken additional time to figure out and why we needed the extension of time to spend the money.
Sounds good to me. I always like accountability. Seeing none, would you like to renew your motion for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill?
I'll renew that motion, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you all. There's no need for a vote, so thank you so very much. We will give it full consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I think our next one is Representative with House File 63, and then Salt. And you will have the same motion for possible inclusion on the bill.
Mr. Chair and Committee, I thank you for listening to us or hearing our description of our program. I'm Dwayne Selk, and this is a program that has been running in Rochester, and as by its name you might understand that it's a particularly important one for us to use all of the methods we can think of to bolster up the healthcare labor force. And so this is one of the pathways that people work through, and that is unique to all the other life opportunities that come along. So they will describe that to you, and I will turn it over to Randy.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Randy Johnson, Executive Director at Workforce Development Incorporated, serving the 10 counties of southeast Minnesota, based in Rochester. I just want to briefly describe the program here. This is known as Bridges to Healthcare. It is a collaboration between the members of the Workforce Center and our other partners at the Hawthorne Education Center, which is the adult basic ed center for Rochester and where this activity all occurs, and RCTC, the Rochester Community and Technical College. It's serving the need, the tremendous need for entry-level people into the healthcare programs. As you know, the largest employer in the state is Mayo Clinic, located in Rochester. They have an insatiable need, but they're not the only player. There's dozens of other long-term care facilities in the area, Olmsted Medical, another major player, and others in the region. This grant started, this process started maybe 10 years ago, small, and grew eventually with some federal funding, and then with state funding under what was called at the time fast track kind of funding, as a predecessor to the Pathways to Prosperity kind of funding. It has now grown then to an ongoing enrollment of approximately 200 people per year, and in fact we have a waiting list any time of 50 to 60 people. It is serving near two-thirds of the people are people of color coming through this program. It has a tremendous outcome. It has increased the college completion rate for, and in fact has exceeded the college completion rate for other folks within these programs at the college. The retention rate, the placement rate, the wage at placements are awesome and off the charts. So we are here to ask, as this bill does, is to ask to continue funding the Bridges to Healthcare and to upgrade that funding to $350,000 per year for the next biennium. I just want to pause then for a moment and give this over for better explanation of what the difference is and how we do our business at that Hawthorne Education Center. So I turn over to Nadine Holthouse.
Before you do, we have a question. Representative, excuse me, Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, this could come at any time, but hopefully you can cover some of this. Many industries partner with the employers, mm-hmm. and I'm just wondering if there's a partnership with was it Mayo Clinic or whoever you're dealing with, yep. Do they invest in this and participate in some way?
They do. Mayo Clinic has been a tremendous partner. They're at the table as we've designed the curriculum. They meet monthly with us, et cetera, and they put in about $500,000 over the last 5.5 years into this project. We also have other private investors. Bremer Bank is a player. United Way has been. That's one of the features. One of the things on private investment, though, is what happens is the same thing happened with Fast Track and Pathways to Prosperity now. Everyone likes a new program that is ready to break out. This one is not only broken out, it's established itself. I want to say this. This program actually 2 years ago was selected as one of the seven finalists from the Kennedy School of Business at Harvard as the best use of public resources in redefining government. So it is a proven program, and it needs to continue to expand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I made a mistake when I asked Representative Salk to move his bill. I'm going to move your bill, House File 63, for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
Please continue. Identify yourself for the tape, and please continue.
I'm Nadine Holthouse. I'm the program manager at Hawthorne Education Center. Last year, we had over 1,200 students attend Hawthorne, and their goal is really to improve their skills so that they can go on to education or training so that they can get jobs to support their families. We put together a unique model. of academic and navigation support. Hawthorne does puts in the academic support to make sure the students are academically ready to go on to college, and the Workforce Center gives navigation support, which helps the students remove barriers so that they can focus on their career pathway. And our community college provides a transition advisor for the students to transition successfully to college. And I don't know if any of you have sent a kid to college lately, but it's not that easy to do. So today, really, we wanted to highlight one of our students who has been gone through the program, and she can tell you what the experience was like for her. This is Elizabeth. Elizabeth, please introduce yourself.
Hello, my name is Elizabeth Gaston. I have been a part of this program, and it has blessed me on so many levels. I'm a single mom with four children. Back in 2007, I was a dropout to poor choices, but children give you that extra oomph to make you try harder. I then got my GED and then tried to do some child development course, but that doesn't pay very much either. So I tried to go back to continue my education. I got my CNA in 2007, and then I got my PCA in 2017, 2018, then I got my PCA, and right now I'm going as a 9-credit student for the nursing program, and on Monday I start at Mayo Clinic. So it's been so supportive. Sometimes, you know, we all go through our ups and downs and feel alone, but this program has been able to keep me strong when I have not felt that strong, and help me provide for my children like I need to. So thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you for coming up here and speaking. It's always good to hear stories where people with a little help from the state actually make a huge difference in their life.
Yes.
Did you have any other testifiers? No is fine.
I'm not shy. I'm Dr. Jennifer Wilson. I'm with Rochester Community and Technical College, and we are delighted to be a partner in this wonderful program. We have seen an increase in retention for these students and persistence. Again, many of them, over 60% of them have at least one, if not multiple, credentials. That is increasing our, like I said, our persistence and our retention rate for the college. This is a group of students who, quite frankly, are amazing because they do have other responsibilities, and juggling and balancing that has been something that they felt has been a challenge, and we have been able to find a process that really works and helps them through that.
Any questions from the members of the committee? Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question. What was your appropriation last time? You said you've asked for an increase of up to $350,000, and I just wondered, you know, what it used to be and what the increase is going for. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it was $250,000 per year. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Gunther?
I was just curious for anybody to answer, is there housing in the port a problem for this population that are starting this program?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it's a problem for everyone in every career, and certainly in the Rochester area. Yes.
Thank you. After reading the Star Trib this morning, I'm really tempted as a construction worker to take a shot at all the municipalities and their fees, but I won't. Maybe I just did. It could have been. Mr. Johnson, I have a question.
Sure.
Do you participate in the Department of Employment and Economic Development's dashboard?
Yes, we do.
So if we go to their website, we'll be able to find out how many people went into the program,
yep,
how many people graduated from the program,
yep,
what their wage was going in, what their wage was coming out, and how long they were employed afterwards, or at least for the first 2 years.
That's right, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. And we do have some data from that same source, known as Workforce One, at the deed level. But I did put that in front of you here. And we do have those kinds of completion rates. Again, college completion rate, 85%, college retention at 90%. The employment rate is at 80%. These are projections from this year, but it's identical to what happened last year. We just carried those over. This is not imagination. When we do those kinds of things, we can calculate where they were when we found them, how many new taxes they're now paying now that they're employed, and if they're on public assistance, how much was avoided because they're now not. And if we add those public assistance avoided together with the new taxes paid, divide by the entire cost of the operation, we're ending up with a 40% return. And so it not only costs, it pays. So,
thank you, Mr. Johnson. Are there any other questions? Representative Haley.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And thank you for the testimony, and I am a supporter of this piece of legislation. So my questions are just to understand a little bit more, and I see you gave us some detail here. So I'm wondering if there's, with the obviously the demand for these types of professionals, do you have any private matching money from the healthcare systems and providers?
Yes, as I mentioned before, excuse me, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, as I had mentioned before, Mayo Clinic to date has put in over $500,000. In fact, they bailed us out 1 year for an additional $100,000. And they have an ongoing commitment now for the next 3 years for another $100,000. Other private monies, again, Bremer Bank, actually getting one of the larger investments from Bremer Bank at just under $100,000. So we are getting private investment into this thing. But the need is goes beyond that. As I say, we're serving about 200 people at this rate, and yet we still have a waiting list of 50 and 60 people. And we have expanded now the entry-level kinds of occupations from what was initially just certified nursing assistant to, how many would you say now?
Well, we have advanced hospital CNA, we have clinical assistants, we have phlebotomy, we have hemodialysis technician. We also have a medical secretary, so quite a few. We are always looking for new pathways.
And Ms. Chair, I also, and Representative Haley, Mayo Clinic also, in addition to the gift aid that they had, is initially established a loan program. It was unique to them and to us for the phlebotomy program because they administered that training themselves, and since has gifted that instead of the loan program. So they are stepping up to the plate.
Just to add something that I think that is very unique about this program is that as a collaborative, along with our employment partners, we meet monthly, and that meeting has never been missed. I mean, we honestly meet monthly with all the partners and sit around the table. So Mayo Clinic is sitting there every month. They have dedicated a person to be there every month for almost 10 years.
Thank you.
Can I ask a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
Thank you very much. With programs like this that you have the results, we have the payback, mm-hmm. It's meeting a need. I think you're using the money effectively. What would it take to scale up? We have these needs all over the state.
Yeah.
Just asking.
To Mr. Chair and Representative Haley, I think you're asking what would it take to do Bridges to Healthcare throughout the state, because you certainly have other providers. That's a good question. They would have to get to the level that this one's at. I'm not bashful about saying this is a mature program. It's taken 10 years to get where you're at. Others may not be, but if you had launched ahead, say 10 years from now, and you had a mature program for every one of the providers, I'm not sure. It would be probably times 10 what you have here. I would say this, as successful as this is, I know that we also are members of the National Association of Workforce Boards, and they give out an award every year for that kind of best kind of programming. And just several years ago, a program similar in scope to this happened in the Tampa Bay area, and just the Tampa Bay area, and it's smaller, obviously, than the Mayo Clinic's footprint and Rochester. But there was $4.5 million went into that program. So Sky's the limit is what you want to invest in this, but the return is there, and the need is there, and it's insatiable. So.
Thank you.
Representative Haley, as you sit on this committee, and I know this is your first term here, I can think of about four off the top of my head programs that are similar, not identical, but very, very similar. Your person sitting next to you could explain one, probably get you to sign on to a bill that he has to fund it, too. So we do have a lot of these programs, and which is a good thing, and we're going to need them. There's a number of people sitting around this table that are going to need them sooner than others, but as we all age out of the workforce. But, yes, this is a program. We have this program in a number of regions of the state. Similar, not the same, not the same name. Seeing no other questions?
Mr. Chair, I just have one last comment. I think the other thing that makes this unique and so successful, I would be remiss if I didn't underscore, it's the partnership that we have here. There's other programs where it's a loose-fit collaboration. It's everyone for themselves, and they come together over a dollar. This one, it actually uses our workforce development as the backbone, and we are then braiding funding from six different streams to do this, and we do to come together monthly and work together as a team. It's an honest team, and it really makes the difference. So.
Representative, final words?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I want to do is to draw your attention to the other side of the whole question and the thing. So those are all operational types of answers and that sort of thing. But I think inside your folder on the right-hand side are clips from people that are impacted, and you'll notice the wide variety of how somebody gets to the doorway of the school. So somebody may have had life challenges that they've made other choices in their lives, but now they find themselves wanting to move forward into a certified area and this particular kind of stuff. Also, there was a mention as to what else is going on in town. I can go around. I think there's somewhere around 10 union trade schools in town. There's about, of course, there's a whole RCT system. So there are many different pathways and ways of getting training. I think this one is the particular thing in the city of Rochester that's so supported by the businesses is that it allows somebody who may not otherwise find a pathway. This is a pathway that you'll have somebody helping guide you and a system that moves you into a direct employment right away, and you're going to be making a living. And Randy's had some ROIs, and I think you may have the things in here where the amount of money that we've invested and or the community's invested, you add that all together and turn it around and look at what that person may have been using in terms of state support and other things to assist in getting through life. And this turns them around, and they become a Mayo Clinic employee. Now, I know that for all of you, that may not mean much. In our community, we know what that means. That means it comes with a very respectable salary. It comes with all of the child support opportunities and all of the health insurance opportunities and the various kinds of things of being part of that workforce. And inside of that workforce is job portability, that you can move through the clinic finding other occupations and that sort of thing. And the reason I bring that up is simply because it's a simple first step that we're providing that then opens the doorways for other things. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, I will renew the motion to hold this over to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 367 to be before the committee and considered for and laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, please.
No more.
Thank you very much.
Proceed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 367 requests support for Exodus Lending. Exodus Lending helps people get out of the payday lending cycle and the payday lending trap. Payday loans are often portrayed as a source of emergency funding for cash-strapped borrowers with nowhere else to turn. But payday loans are by their very nature set up to trap borrowers in loans with exorbitant interest rates and terms that force borrowers into a cycle of debt and indebtedness with negative financial consequences. Exodus Lending creates a path for those trapped in the payday lending cycle to escape, satisfy the loan, and reestablish themselves free of that debt. In 2017, the legislature provided Exodus with support to expand their service capacity to those burdened by payday loans. House File 367 requests a continuation of that funding so that they may assist more borrowers. With me today is Sarah Nelson-Pallmeyer, the Executive Director of Exodus Lending.
If I might ask a question, why did you only ask for $100,000? You could just leave that alone and take that as a...
Well, Mr. Chair, you're free to run with it when it comes time to assemble the omnibus bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for having us here today and for your interest in the work we do at Exodus Lending. Again, my name is Sarah Nelson-Pallmeyer, and I'm the Executive Director at Exodus Lending. Exodus Lending is a Minnesota nonprofit organization that was founded in 2014 and in 2015 began offering loans to individuals to free them from the cycle of payday loan use and debt. So again, as Representative Dabney said, payday loans are small dollar loans, usually in the $200 to $500 range, that are marketed as quick fix solutions to financial emergencies. Unlike a typical loan, payday lenders require the borrower to pay off the loan in full 2 weeks later, typically on their next payday. Lenders require direct access to the borrower's bank account and make the loans without fully investigating whether or not a borrower has the ability to repay. Unfortunately, payday loans carry an annual interest rate of over typically 200% or more, making them extremely difficult to pay off. Payday borrowers almost always end up taking out additional payday loans to pay off previous ones. In 2017, again, Minnesota payday borrowers averaged 8 loans to pay off previous ones. So not just one loan, but 8 loans in order to get out of the cycle. And averaged 8 loans each, with 58% of borrowers taking out at least 5 loans. And for most participants, the result are financial struggles, including delinquency on other bills, bank penalty fees, even bankruptcy. And the majority of persons who take out these loans find themselves trapped by a cycle of debt, even though they must have a steady income, such as a paycheck, in order to qualify for a loan. Payday loans are a problem statewide here in Minnesota, and the three counties with the highest per capita usage of payday loans in 2017 were Anoka County, Clay County, and Blue Earth County. In 2017, more than 330,000 loans were issued to Minnesota borrowers by payday lenders, costing them nearly $10 million in interest and fees. And those $10 million were not available for groceries, rent, mortgage payments, gasoline to get to work, child care expenses, utility bills, and so forth. So Exodus Lending refinances payday loans for Minnesotans trapped in what we call the payday loan debt trap, and we charge no interest or fees for our work. We connect individuals with resources that can help them to manage their money better and to learn how to spend within their means, if that's at all possible. In 2017, as stated, the legislature allocated a $100,000 grant to Exodus Lending to help us expand our work. And we're so grateful to the legislature for your support, and we're thrilled to be able to share our successes with you. And a big thank you to all of those who helped on this in 2017, especially Chair Mahoney for leadership on this issue. We thank you for that. We see the funding from the legislature as capacity building, and we committed to use those funds to reach more individuals and more communities in Minnesota. So to see our success, in 2017, for example, we worked with 54 new program participants. Each of those is labor-intensive as we meet with people one-on-one. And we received our first check from the state in January of 2018, and that year we added 100 participants. And so 54 the previous year, 43 the year before that, and now 100 last year, almost double the previous year. In January of this year alone, we added 17 new program participants, so our program is really growing. And in addition to having more participants in the program, we've added capacity to reach persons in more of the state throughout Minnesota. So since the legislature approved this grant in 2017, we've enrolled participants from 11 additional counties, and 10 of those are from greater Minnesota. So an example is Clay County. Clay County, as I said, has a high rate of payday loan usage per capita. And so we decided to use some of the funds we received from the legislature to do extensive outreach in the Moorhead area. We partnered with local elected officials, including your colleague, Representative Ben Lean, to convene a discussion about alternatives to payday loans. We also contracted with a consultant from Moorhead to connect us with organizations and agencies to help us spread the word about our program. The funds also allowed us to increase our staff capacity so that our staff can not only enroll participants, but can also travel throughout Minnesota to meet with local and communities and organizations to talk about our work and how we can assist persons trapped by payday loan debt. As we look toward the future, we would like to do more outreach in other areas of Minnesota hurt by the payday loan industry, focusing on Blue Earth and Stearns County and Olmsted County as well, all areas of high payday loan use. We'd also like to be able to begin reporting payment history for our program participants to the credit reporting agencies, improving their scores, and thus giving our participants another support as they become financially fit. Additional funding would allow us to pursue these goals, and we are appreciative of the committee taking time to hear about HF 367. Thank you.
Thank you. I have one question, and then I'm going to, just to clarify, when you say participants, you mean clients or people who have loans and are using your services, correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, we do use the term participants okay. for those folks who are working with us. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Cagle?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Nelson Pallmeyer, do you see a lot of clients from around military bases? I know that a lot of the payday loan lenders target military families and people serving. And so I was wondering if you work a lot with military families.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yeah, thank you for that question. Actually, there have been restrictions on payday lending on military bases and because it was such a problem for individuals in the military. So there's a restriction, interest rate caps of 36% for people who are serving active military. Now, we have, so we don't have so many serving actively who are struggling with payday loan debt, which is a great thing. We have worked with some of our client base are people who are retired military or former military, I guess, who are struggling now in civilian life trying to pay their debts. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It just seems if it's good enough for the military folks that we should probably look at some of those practices across the state and across the country.
Funny she should ask. I think Representative Dabney has a bill that might address that at some point a little later on in session. But Representative Moran? Representative Moran, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have like a few questions. Where are you located? That's one of the questions. And then I was just thinking, how do you know you are being successful? Have you seen people returning or have it stopping? Or how do you quantify success?
Mr. Chair, Representative, We are located in Minneapolis. Our office is in Minneapolis currently, although this afternoon I'm signing a lease. We're crossing the river into St. Paul. But we serve everyone. Sorry, I haven't told you that.
You could have said something earlier. and it's a nicer space on top of it.
Why did you think I asked that first question?
We are currently in Minneapolis. and it's important to know that we serve individuals statewide. We consider ourselves and always have a statewide agency. People qualify for our program if they are Minnesota residents. That's the very first question we always ask. If they are struggling with payday loan debt, if they have loans that are less than $1,000, if they've been caught in that trap, so if they paid one loan or if they've gotten a second loan to repay back the first and a third to repay back the second, that sort of thing, if they're caught in that cycle, and if they have steady income of some sort, and that can be employment and that can be public assistance that's steady. So if someone comes to us with those issues, then almost always that person will qualify for our program and be accepted into our program. And again, the way we work is that we pay off the payday lender. So if someone comes to us with a loan to Ace Cash or Payday America or an online lender, then we will pay that off, and then they will pay us back every month for 12 months. We just divide their payment. So if they owe $360, we divide that payment by 12, and they pay us back $30 a month. We do have some who have come back to us for additional help, and it's usually a year or two later they find themselves in the same boat. Most of our program participants do not go back to a payday lender once they stop. Once they've worked with us, they realize that that is not going to be helpful for them. But there have been a handful who have gone back to a payday lender. Does that answer your question, Representative?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, are the clients or participants able to come to Exodus Lending for a loan?
Chair and Representative, are you asking the question?
Are they able
just to get a loan from us for cash?
Yes.
That's not our program model at the current time. Basically, what we do is we just pay off the payday lenders. So if someone comes to us and says, you know, may I have a loan for $400? Can you give me $400? That's not our program model right now. We're really a small program with big with big success doing just the refinancing of payday loan debt.
One last question, Mr. Chair, I think. So you're requesting $100,000, and you added staff. So I guess how much is paid towards staff versus your ability to help individuals?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we use some of that for staff, obviously, because it's a very labor-intensive program. Our funding for our loans is actually out of a completely separate pool, so we don't use funding that we get or donations and grants for the loan pool. The loan pool is totally separate, and that's funded for the most part because it's a revolving loan pool. But as we grow, we have had investments in our program. I have secured six investments from individuals, $10,000 or more, on a three-year basis. So they lend us money for 3 years. I don't pay interest, just like we don't charge interest to our program participants. But then after 3 years, I ask the investor in our program if she or he would like to reinvest that money, would like to get it back, or would like to donate it to the organization. And so far, that's been successful. So it's different funding, but it does fully allow us to do our work with people who come to us for service.
Thank you.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just out of curiosity, I know it revolves. What is the corpus amount that is available for loans? Because that $100,000 seems like a chip shot. I think the amount that would be required would be a whole lot more than that. So how much is in the total amount that you get to work with every year?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I wanted to make sure I understand your question. Are you asking how much is in the loan pool?
Yeah.
The loan pool. Right now, we have about $90,000 that's either lent out or in the bank, still waiting to be lent out for individuals. So it's about a $90,000 loan pool.
Representative Gunther.
To me, that means that you only have about 300 people participating?
We had about 260. Right. We only started in 2015. And we've been working hard to get the word out. Again, last year we were able to help 100 new enrollees, and this year, you know, we've 17 in January so far, so we feel that number is going to go up again.
I'm excited about this program. I think if people got the word that this is available to them, maybe we get a lot of people out of debt and misery quicker. I would. How do you get the word out?
Thank you for the question, Mr. Chair. Representative, we have been doing a lot of work with publicity this last year, and that has paid off. So we have, you know, a lot of new participants because of that. So we have multiple ways of getting the word out. I have a volunteer now who has actually gone to all the libraries in Ramsey County, for example, and put up flyers with little pull tabs at the bottom. And we do that at the food shelves. Our friend Missy's going to talk about, you know, her experience, and she knows that people take these tabs off at food shelves, too. We've had stories on NPR. We've had stories in the Star Tribune. I've written letters to the editor in the Star Tribune. Anytime we get the word out, that's really helpful. When I was up in Clay County, up in Moorhead, I was on television. We had articles in the paper. That really helped. So I also speak a lot at churches and community groups, and I always tell people when I'm there, whether or not you've had experience with payday loan debt, you know somebody who has, and they may not have talked about it with you. But there are so many people in the state who've struggled with this, and so keep talking about what we do. Share our story with other people, because you will be reaching someone who will then come to us and say, yeah, a friend told me about that, or my state legislator told me about that.
Representative Dabney, you have another witness?
I do. We have a program participant here this morning, Missy Juliet.
Why don't we hear from you? Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
My name, my legal name is Melissa Juliet, but I go by Missy. So I want to say good morning, Mr. Chair and representatives, and thank you for taking the time to hear my story as it relates to payday loans and my subsequent partnership with Exodus. Just a little bit of background about me so you can see who takes out payday loans. I live in White Bear Lake with my two children and my partner, and I have worked at the University of Minnesota for over 6.5 years now. So maybe not your likely candidate for a payday loan, but I'll continue on with my story. 2.5 years ago, I found myself a single mother, and things looked okay as I was starting out on my own. But then I got my first financial surprise. My son's Social Security survivor benefits were cut by $200. That was a big line in my budget. After that, after I left a bad situation, I had my children in weekly to biweekly therapy. So my copays then were about another $200 a month that I wasn't planning on. So bear with me here. Oh, so with that, I fell behind on all of my bills, every single one of them, including my rent. And I was in a pinch. I didn't know what to do. And so I did something I thought I would never do again. In my early 20s, I had taken out a payday loan and was able to break the cycle effectively. However, when I did this, I had no idea how bad it would spiral. I took out my first loan. It was $480, and I was expected to pay back $552 in 2 weeks. That's $72 in fees, just to borrow that. This seemed okay. I thought I could do it and get back on my feet, but the fees and my bills just spiraled out of control. So I ended up with 4 payday loans, all of those fees and everything, just to try and make ends meet. And every 2 weeks, I was going, once I got paid, I would go to Payday America, and then I would go across the street to unloan to pay that off, and the other two were online. So I didn't have to face them and feel ashamed while I was waiting in line. However, getting a little brighter, my employer, as I mentioned, at the University of Minnesota offers an employee assistance program, and I was able to get in touch with Lutheran Social Services, which is part of the program that got me in touch with Exodus Lending, because I wanted to look at consolidating my debt, and they said payday loans were not an option. So on July 3rd, I mustered up my courage and I called Exodus to see if they could help me. And I was met with Kathy, who had no judgments. She met me with open arms and walked me through the process. I had to bring my loan documents and my pay stubs, as Sarah said, and she took the time to go through, step me through the program, and ran out on a Saturday to pay out my loan because it was facing court dates. So with that, I was able to come up with a monthly plan and get that paid back in August of 2017. And Sarah hadn't mentioned, but they also do an incentive program to help you get back on your feet, which really helped me. So I met with a financial counselor 3 times in order to achieve that, and it really, really benefited me. So I just wanted to close with saying this program has helped hundreds of Minnesotans and break the payday loan cycle, and I really hope that you will consider helping even more Minnesotans with this grant. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a hard story for all of us to hear, and I'm sure it's a harder story for you to live. Thank you for coming down and sharing it with us today. Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to have House File 367 heard today.
Unfortunately, I just noticed that I skipped one of my our committee members.
I noticed the paper slide over to your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, the testifier answered my question of if there was any financial literacy component to the program, and so I'm really happy to hear that there is. So testifier answered my question. Thank you.
Thank you. So your motion is to lay it over for possible inclusion?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you for the good work you do. I know how difficult that is. I've got a number of them in my district. Glad you're moving to St. Paul, too. Representative Zong. Representative Zong, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the bill.
Please proceed. I'm sorry, did you move your bill?
Yes.
Okay, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, this is my first bill that I signed on to and the first bill in this committee, so I do have a treat. So the page will be passing it out in a few minutes. But today here I have a legislative proposal that would provide funding to the city of Minneapolis and city of St. Paul fire departments to provide and support culturally specific EMS training academies. The EMS academies have been a great tool to train and place students into the EMS and fire service. Students have been placed in EMS jobs around the state with numerous EMS systems. This funding would assist in assuring these programs continue to flourish and provide the EMS industry with trained professionals in EMS. With me today to testify on these programs, and this legislative proposal is Matt Simpson, the Assistant Chief of EMS for the City of St. Paul Fire Department, and Buck McAlpin with the Minnesota Ambulance Association.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for entertaining us to come and speak with you today about this program. This program was, the inception was 2009 when it was really noticed and appreciated that there was a lack of diversity in EMS and the fire service in general. We have gone on to, with some great support here with us today, graduated over 250 members from this program since 2009, putting on 16 academies. And again, it's been stated that we have not only had members from this graduation group become St. Paul firefighters and paramedics now, and I'll speak to that in just a moment as well, but we've had also individuals that have become EMTs and paramedics for various services throughout the metro area, police officers. We have a few that decided EMS pre-hospital wasn't necessarily for them. They've become nurses. So I think this is a great stepping stone for what this program not only offers to these individuals, but us as a community as well. So I can really only speak to what the successes are. We've obviously have some attrition with, as you would with expect with any program, but the successes have by far again as is testify or a testimony to our success sitting to my right. So questions that I might entertain about the program.
Seeing none, Mama, why don't we proceed to the next testimony?
Mr. Chair, members, Buck McElpin, I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. We've worked closely with Chief Simpson and the folks of St. Paul Fire, Minneapolis Fire. And really, if you look at our EMS system across the state, we have lots of openings and lots of holes is what we do. And I will say the 25 years I've been down here, I've been challenged by numerous legislators about some of our cultural diversity in emergency medical services and even the fire service. And to Chief Simpson's comments, we've worked pretty hard on trying to address those. There's very few of these academies, the one in Minneapolis and the one in St. Paul, that actually continues to work hard and reach out, and most importantly, offer them a livable wage while they're in these academies, and be sure that we place them in the job field. So besides just the governmental base side of what they do as cities employing people, we also have to remember there's North Memorial Healthcare, there's Alina Healthcare, there's Healtheast Healthcare, there's Gold Cross Ambulance. These are very large healthcare systems that have EMS systems all over the world. And I'm looking at Representative Sundin, our good friend, the Cloquet Fire Chief, tells me he has a hard time hiring folks in Cloquet and Virginia and Hibbing. And from the Ambulance Association's side, Mr. Chair, we have to start to look at how we convince some of our young friends up here in the audience to say Cloquet, Minnesota is a great spot to live, and so is Hibbing. And our communities are diverse all over the state, and how do we look differently at how we move folks into that? These two cities have absorbed a lot of the cost to not only train to place folks into their own academies, but how can we help offset some of that with maybe some state resources to be sure we're taking more of a holistic approach to look at how we develop more of a job placement program like we heard from the Mayo program earlier today and really expand that in EMS. So appreciate the support, and Representative Zung for carrying this, and we'll sure stand for questions.
Well, I'll see no questions. I'm going to ask. Oh, there, now the hands are coming. I'll ask the first one. What other resources come to the table? I mean, if you're providing, if this program is providing EMS training and being used across the state, are the healthcare facilities contributing? Are the other cities that hire these young men and women contributing? Or is it just coming out of the St. Paul, Minneapolis budget?
Mr. Chair, so a large part obviously comes from the city of St. Paul, but we also have partners in the MinSCU system, so Inverhill Century College, as well as there is also a financial literacy portion to this. We had Camfer Fiscally Fit that was a part of this initially, but now we're using partnering with Highway Federal Credit Union. And what they do is they also, not only while they're learning EMS services, they're also learning what is the necessary need for a savings account, a checking account, etc. So
how to avoid payday lenders.
How to avoid payday lenders, as we just heard, exactly. So I think this is a very broad-reaching, wide partnerships. We have, again, the services that Buck mentioned, North Memorials, the United Healthcare, Alina, they have all benefited from this group as well, Healtheast. So it's
that's the premise of my question. Is Healtheast or Alina or North Memorial putting money into these job training programs that they profit from?
Sure, Alina has, and I guess to give you a specific dollar amount, what every service has provided, I could not support that today. But, yes, everybody that has been mentioned has had a hand in some form of support of this program. Exactly.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Did anyone have a question? Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what is the plan? What is your plan to do with the additional dollars?
Well, obviously, to expand the program would be ideal. Right now, what we have in front of us is a Right Track program that we do benefit. That's through the Parks and Rec program. And Right Track offers students between 18 and 24 years of age. We would like to expand that beyond the 24-year-old deadline, really, because there are a number of interested candidates, if you will, that supersede the date range that we're allowed to work within now. We would love to expand that program to two academies a year. We've attempted to do that, but it became fiscally just not possible. So to bring that back would be ideal for us, if that answers your question.
Yes. And, Mr. Chair, how do you do your outreach? How do one from communities of color find out about the program?
Sure. So we have a community relations chief within the fire department. We have a number of partners, community action partners, that we market the program. We go to the schools. We go to the counselors. We look for those individuals that are interested in perhaps experiencing what it means to be an EMS provider, a police officer, a firefighter. I would love to have all of them become firefighter paramedics for the city of St. Paul, but knowing that's not a realistic outcome, to expand those opportunities to other services to really diversify what we offer as a system throughout the state is ideal.
One last question. You know, sometimes
Mr. Moran, could you speak into the microphone, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So sometimes, you know, individuals cannot see that possibility or see that this is something that they can do for many different reasons. What does the program look like? Or, you know, one, it is, you know, what do the outreach look like? You know, because sometimes people cannot visualize that vision of being an EMT or working in the hospital. They just can't see that. And so, you know, having an outreach where you're bringing in, you know, folks of color to see the possibilities with some type of support, you know, what do that look like in helping those individuals to see the possibilities?
Certainly. So we have an orientation program along with the marketing, again, that we do. And we bring individuals in that are interested in our program and really make sure they understand what it is to means to provide the service to the community via pre-hospital. So we've had students that recognize once they get into the program that perhaps pre-hospital is not for them. The chaotic, almost sometimes uncanny scenes that you deal with. This individual was very, very clear that wasn't for her, but she went on to become, still in the medical field, just not in the pre-hospital field. So we try to really paint a very broad and clear picture of what they would expect and how really the rewards of what they are providing to their communities that they're going to receive through that training. I don't know if that answers your question specifically or not.
We can talk offline.
Oh, okay, that would be great.
Thank you.
Representative Gunther?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. McAlpin, in Greater Minnesota, there are places that you have to have an EMT or first responder go more than 25 miles to get to an injured person. There are some communities that the only first responders and EMTs we have are with the fire department because nobody else is interested in them. And you can't get people to be trained. Are these programs, I noticed this is from Minneapolis and St. Paul, and I truly respect and love Minneapolis and St. Paul, but I'm from Greater Minnesota. I think we have to have something going for us. What do we have going for us? Where do we get our training from?
Sure, Mr. Chair and Representative Gunther. Let's talk to some of the fire folks the other day. It's hard to say this, but it's actually true. In 2019, in certain parts of rural Minnesota, if you called 911, we cannot guarantee the ambulance or first responder squad will show up. I can't guarantee that. The coverage is thin. You said 25 miles. Representative Gunther, there's spots that have 40-mile response times up in Thief River Falls and way up in those parts of the state. The reason why we've identified these two programs is they're actually up and functioning and operational. We do need to expand that. The Ambulance Association's got a very aggressive group of rural sustainability. That group's kind of talked about money's a good way to help with it, but how do we support programs like this and expand them around the state and start to look at different spots of the workforce and what we do with them?
Ms. Harbison-Gunther.
Just out of curiosity, what does a fireman and an EMT have when they're finished their 30 years of being a fireman or EMT in greater Minnesota?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, depending on the size of your community, Representative Gunther, some get a couple hundred dollars a year to be on there. An average ambulance attendant that's a volunteer for a rural ambulance service that does 30 years of service gets a stipend from the state for about $8,500. And an average volunteer firefighter, depending on the size of their pension fund, could be $600 to a couple thousand dollars a year times their year of service.
Thank you.
Wow. Representative North.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for bringing this bill. The question that I have is, how many of the trainees become advanced life support and versus becoming basic life support? You know, the two difference in EMT services.
Great question, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative. The group that you see to my right, I would say, Again, I will keep pointing to them as examples of going beyond paramedic or going beyond the initial EMT school, and most of them, if not all of them, have put in for and applied and successfully graduated from a paramedic program. So they take the initial EMT course, emergency medical technician, and then they advance on their own, mind you, that to promote to paramedic and put themselves through paramedic school, and even a few examples of first-time graduates in their family from college. So I think there's a lot of encouragement beyond just the education initial from the EMT course and then advance up through a higher education degree, not only that, plus the advanced life support that you asked, inquired about.
Representative North.
Mr. Chair, the assumption is everybody will get the basic life support trainings, and it's up to the participant to move on to the advanced services, ALS.
That is correct.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Zong, did you have some examples you wanted to bring down and testify to the great program this is?
No. I have one for sure. Brittany, if you'd like
I didn't see any point to bring this many young men and women into the committee room without having to at least hear from them.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. This is Brittany Baker.
Brittany, why don't you sit close to the mic there so you can use that. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Brittany Baker. I am a graduate from the 2012 St. Paul Fire EMS Academy. I continued on with the encouragement from Chief Simpson and Captain Ken Adams and most of my classmates up there to paramedic school. Became the first in my family to graduate from college. And as of last year, with, again, the encouragement from these two and my other friends, I became the second African-American female to ever be hired on the St. Paul Fire Department, and at this current time, I am the only one. And some of that recruiting that Representative Moran asked about, the chief and the captains make sure that on top of them going out, they send us out as well so that students can actually see people that have gone through the program and see that it is possible, so they're not just getting someone coming and saying, hey, we run this program, you should come through, but they actually get people who have gone through it so that they know that they can do it and that it is possible, and we continue to give them as much encouragement and help as possible. We're all available by phone or by email or at Station 51 all the time. So it's without it, I honestly don't know if I would have ever finished college or even considered this job field. So, yeah.
I'm going to ask this question first. What happened to the other African-American woman at St. Paul Fire? Did she move on to a private facility, or?
She retired in 2007, I believe.
Thank you. Representative Sundin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to any of the testifiers. What would scare the dickens out of me if I were a new citizen to the state of Minnesota and didn't understand English quite well, or and I was injured or ingested something or whatever the emergency situation was, how could I communicate with the EMTs that respond to my emergency situation? Is there, given the language barriers, that could be any language, given the influx of immigrants from all over the world, you know, that's our new citizens, are they at risk, or is there measures to bridge that language gap?
We have, I mean, if you look behind you, we have people from Belize, Somalia, Iraq, Mexico. Abdi, who is Somali, could not make it this morning, but we have a vast majority, like almost every race and nationality that has come to Minnesota has been represented through our program, including Corinne. So we offer translators. A lot of times people call us fire department mainly if they need someone that needs to interpret and they can't get a hold of the language line, they'll call. We've had members from our class go out with our community paramedics that we used to have to help translate with the patients that they have seen in their homes, whether they speak Spanish, Korean, Somali, whatever it is, we try and accommodate. We have Hmong. So in quite a few of us, we're all still good friends, and we sit around the table, and we try and learn each other's languages. We do potlucks about 2 to 3 times a year where we all bring in cultural food and continue to learn about each other's cultures and different things so that we can not only know more about each other and love each other more, but that we can offer that to the community so that people feel comfortable no matter who's coming to look at you. I have myself been trying to learn Hmong, so when I go to patients, I don't speak it very well, and I don't speak a lot of it, but I go and they feel a sense of a little bit more sense of calm when they come in and they see, they're like, oh, you speak Hmong, but I learned that from my friends at 51, and I would not have learned that without them and without this program.
Thank you. That's very comforting.
They just have more courage than you. I have a question, not so much for the witness, but this bill talks about culturally specific minority-based emergency medical services, and neither of the two non-regulars here spoke to the culturally specific. So if you could kind of tell us how this is culturally specific, because you were pretty non-culturally specific in your explanations of what you were trying to do.
Certainly, fair enough, and I will attempt to enlighten if I am able. I think culturally specific would indicate that we just have a lack of representation from the different makeups of our community. So community specific or cultural specific specificity would include teaching and being able to speak to medical concerns that people may, in fact, call 911 for, similar to what was the question that was just asked. How do we speak to somebody that doesn't speak English necessarily? What is that? How do we make that situation more understood, relaxing, and really appreciating that the family can understand why we would take somebody to the hospital? Mm-hmm. I think that would be... Mr. Chair, I don't know if that specifically answers your question, but you take away what each one of us looks like, and underneath this skin, bodies are bodies. So culturally specific EMS for a member of a different community that maybe doesn't speak English is not going to necessarily mean the treatment is going to vary, but the understanding and explanation of how we get there and make them appreciate what we're trying to do and why we're trying to do it, I think, is more specific to what that is
what that's being taught. How do we culturally understand as providers what is acceptable as far as delivering a baby, perhaps, things of that nature. So the students teach just as much as they are taught, I think, if that's a fair summation.
Thank you. It's somewhat well done, but so I'll ask it this way. If you're training for EMS, that's a pretty serious training. No questions about it. Do you spend 50% of your time teaching on the EMS piece and 50% on kind of the cultural sensitivities and understandings of who you're working with? Or do you spend 90% on the EMS and 10% on the cultural specifics?
I would say if I had to give a percentage, I would say the 90-10 split would be more accurate. And then I would also argue that we probably spend beyond 100% if that's an appreciable, allowable percentage, that what we learn from the students that are from the community that are not represented well, I would say that makes up over 100% of what we learn. We really do. We are taught just as much as we learn, and I can't understate that. CPR is CPR, but learning a different culture is obviously something that we all appreciate. And to Firefighter Baker's point, that is something that we continue outside of the classroom and focus perhaps not enough in the classroom, but the curriculum is such that we really need to spend 90% of that time, if you will, to make sure that everybody that's graduating from this program goes out with a good understanding of how to help.
And one final question before we call for other witnesses. Do you have incidences, or how many of your, I think you said you trained 206 for some reason, that number rang a bell with me. How many of those stay in the metro area versus go out to Bemidji or Worthington or whatever town might have a need for EMS?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, it's 260, so you had your numbers right, close to it anyway. And the metro would probably be the biggest benefactor of these individuals. I don't know if there are many out state. That would be something as a follow-up I could absolutely provide to the committee. And but it would be a very heavy-centric metro percentage.
If it's not too much, if you could just pass along to the author that how many go outstate?
Certainly, yeah, we can get that.
Greater Minnesota.
We can get that.
They don't go outstate. They go to Greater Minnesota.
Greater Minnesota.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
We have one testifier that has indicated she would like to testify.
Della,
Ms. Lee.
Sure, we have one more.
We'll just clear off the witness table, and you know. Why don't you sit down, Ms. Lee, and the other testifier.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
My name is Arnella Kurdic. I'm a first-generation Muslim Bosnian refugee that came here in the 90s. I'm a graduate of the 2011 Academy. Before that, I really didn't know what kind of field of work I wanted to go in. I thought about healthcare, and a friend suggested the EMS Academy. So I got my EMT in 2011. I TA'd a couple of the classes to kind of just give back because it was such a good experience. Sorry, bear with me. I'm a terrible public speaker. thank you. So I TA'd a couple classes just kind of like to help give back. Work with some of the students, kind of get some experience, and just kind of think about if it was something that I really wanted to do next. The following year, in 2012, we started the BLS ambulance interfacility trucks out of Station 51 through the fire department. And while I was in paramedic school, that's where I worked to get some experience to make me a more competitive candidate to find a paramedic job. So the way that it kind of worked for me was the EMS Academy was kind of the opportunity that opened the door to figure out as a young adult what I wanted to do, give me a certain skill set that I could use. The BLS ambulance that works at a Station 51 provided me some experience and really to solidify what I've learned, how to do my job, how to react in a variety of situations in the pre-hospital field and kind of get comfortable. And then with the support of my classmates, our educators, the fire department, I was able to work, continue to get a livable wage, and then also go to paramedic school at the same time. Now I am about, this is my fifth year working as a paramedic for an ambulance service. We cover Dakota County. I guess the most outstate that we go is the city of Coates. And it is pretty rural in some spots. But what I really wanted to kind of stress was kind of growing up in the U.S., English is a second language. As a female and as a Muslim, really the EMS field wasn't something that was encouraged by my family. It's not in our culture to work this kind of job. But going through the academy and feeling supported by my fellow students and our instructors and Chief Simpson and really kind of gave me the confidence to be able to move forward. So it is definitely a starting point for people to give them direction on where to go in life. In addition to that, a lot of us don't just get the education portion out of it and college credits. The academy is kind of like a crash course in life. A lot of us have really come to our own as young adults, learning how to be in like a professional setting, for example, how to work with a variety of people who speak different languages, who practice different cultures, and they said, they have the financial, fiscal training before the academy. They offer kind of courses to learn medical terminology, if English is a second language, to make it a little bit easier for you to understand the material, the course material work. So I think it's been an absolutely wonderful experience, and I think it's really important. It's kind of brought a variety of students through the door, and it has put out a variety of backgrounds within our providers in the healthcare field that is hard to come by.
See? Once you get started, that public speaking is pretty simple.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
I don't see any questions, so I'm going to quickly move to Ms. Lee. Thank you again.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jean Lee, or Reverend Dr. Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, R&R Family Centers, and APAC, which is a housing consortium. You have a handout here, so I'll, in case my voice doesn't carry or I have problems speaking. I'm a former Fortune 500 corporate auditor who switched to fixing problems and developing solutions from addressing the unserved and underserved needs of the community, especially with children, families, seniors, the disabled, victims, the low-income and our cultural communities. There is an immediate need to expand personnel and training in the medical emergency response areas necessary for aiding people from our cultural communities. I was out of the hospital for less than 12 hours exhibiting at the Minneapolis Community Connections over at the Convention Center when I collapsed and was ambulanced to HCMC's emergency room. First to respond was a Minneapolis evaluator out of the assessor's office and his daughter, who had asked for help from some firefighters, Minneapolis firefighters who passed by. They said they were there to exhibit and said to contact the paramedics. The convention security and others kind of stood around and watched, and then I heard someone say, call 911 before I was carried out in the stretcher. Now, I Being a first responder trained by the U.S. Department of Justice National Office of Victims Assistance, I do know that there were gaps in medical responses needed from the incident site to the professional and community responses that were happening there, to paramedics that were intervening, and even to the ER nurse practice who was practicing, including the one who was assigned to me but was passing on some false information and didn't want to provide me care. Medications that were needed by IV weren't done because they had trouble putting in the IVs. And so there's some other things that can be addressed, but they're more technical. I was lucky I did not have a stroke, because there was a standard 4-hour limit to get me the required medication or surgical intervention, and that time had elapsed, and it was just a short distance between the convention center and HCMC. The medical responses I had were inappropriate for a person having a heart attack, too. What actually happened was that I had a reaction to eating strawberries that had some chemicals and pesticides still on it. As it was determined later, but and you've heard of people dying from allergic reactions to peanuts and other foods, E. coli and so forth. Now, my father did die of complications from a stroke because nobody knew enough to appropriately help him from the time of the incident and afterwards. I wasn't there, but even with the years of helping the American Heart Association and working with the Department of Health, I myself was not informed on the signs of stroke or the immediate medical intervention and medications needed. My brother, who was there, didn't know the information either. And we've since then learned that there was insufficient information and care given afterwards that could have been resulted. So improved care is an ongoing concern. I had another brother die of heart attack because there were friends around him, and the only thing they knew was to call 911 and wait till the paramedics arrived. I think the types of life-saving and medical response trainings would be important in saving the lives of all and expanding the number of trained personnel needed in serving our communities by anyone who's available there, including there will be people that won't want to help. So one St. Paul Fire Department offers free CPR training for anyone who wants it. And I was at a University of Minnesota, a free updated course where instructors include physicians and the Anoka Fire Department. And there's other emergency responses that families, friends, and communities need to know too. So it's hoped that this training that the paramedics and the EMS receive will include train-the-trainer education that will enable them to pass on the knowledge to the community for families and community responses, too. We totally support this legislation and some of the needed first steps. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the witness? Seeing none, Representative Zong, do you have any final words? Oh, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Reverend Zhang. Just want to share that on Fire Service Day, week before last, I think, I had the opportunity to meet with the Minneapolis Fire Chief, who talked very positively about using the EMS Academy as a way to make sure that Minneapolis's fire service personnel look like Minneapolis, and that it's a path not only to get the EMS staff they need, but then it's good pickings for firefighters. Once these folks get a little experience under their belt, they know the candidates, they've seen the candidates know the city, they know the community, and it's a very positive pathway. And it was interesting to see the fire chief's commitment to a diverse fire service, which in historical terms has been a challenge. But his commitment and the kind of strategic value of the EMS Academy in supporting a more diverse and representative fire service in Minneapolis. So, Representative Zhang, thank you for the bill.
You're welcome.
Thank
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Backer, did you have a question?
Yes, I did. My question deals, and maybe Representative Zong, you may not know this one. This may be one to Buck. But, you know, on Labor Day this year, I had an ambulance run in which a person could only speak Spanish. Well, luckily, we were able to figure out his phone and dial one of the family members so we could provide the care and so forth. My question deals with how are we going to get this out in greater Minnesota? You know, because we have these same issues as fire and EMS in greater Minnesota, even in my district. So, and again, that might be a better question for Buck.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Backer, I think Representative Sundin kind of brought that up a little bit, too, about outstate. And that's why we want to start to use some of these academies and how we do some of the stuff outstate. And I think to Representative Gunther's comments, we may have some opportunities as we work with the chair and the author that there's some different things we could do with this, how it has more of a statewide focus as we further the conversation.
Okay,
absolutely realize it is a problem.
Yeah, thank you. I had to step out ahead of meeting, so I appreciate that. So,
that's it. Final words, Representative Zong?
Mr. Chair, members, I ask for your support this bill and for possible inclusion in your honest bill. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Seeing no other business before the committee, move to adjourn.